I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Not so long ago, doctors were reluctant to prescribe opioids or painkillers for fear of addiction. That changed for a variety of reasons. The CDC found that the amount of opioids prescribed per person in 2016 was three times the amount prescribed in 1999. The center also reported in 2016 that 42,000 Americans died from an opioid overdose, and that's five times the rate in 1999. This is a public health crisis and a national tragedy experienced in many communities and by many families across the country as prescriptions have migrated from the medicine cabinet to the street. President Trump went to New Hampshire last week to announce his plan to address the epidemic.
We're also taking action to prevent addiction by addressing the problem of over-prescribing. We're going to cut nationwide opioid prescriptions by one-third over the next 3 years. We're also going to make sure that virtually all prescriptions reimbursed by the federal government follow best practices for prescribing. We'll ensure that opioid addiction is not subsidized by the American taxpayer. The best way, so important, and the best way to beat the drug crisis is to keep people from getting hooked on drugs to begin with.
Today in Radio Times, the how, the why, the what of the opioid crisis. These are powerful drugs, both legal and illegal, that include oxycodone, hydrocodone, morphine, heroin, fentanyl. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is Jonathan Reisman. He's an emergency room physician at the Schuylkill Medical Center. That's in Pottsville, PA, outside of Philadelphia. Also at Cooper Hospital in Camden, New Jersey. And John Reisman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And joining us from the studios of Harvard University is Anupam Jena, Associate Professor of Healthcare Policy at Harvard Medical School and a physician in the Department of Medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital. He's also a faculty research fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Anupam Jena, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
Let me begin with just to spend a moment talking about the fact that on average 115 people every day in this country die from an overdose of some kind of opioid. Help us understand what that means, Anupam Jena, in terms of our country, our culture, our economy, our identity. It's just an astounding number.
The number's scary for a number of reasons. So first of all, this is preventable. Now, we're not talking about a disease outbreak that is out of our control. These are things that are happening to Americans that are largely preventable. They're in the control of physicians and other healthcare providers. And so just by that measure alone, it's a terrible thing. I think the other thing, and I appreciate Jonathan's input on this, is I think that we focus on opioid overdoses and deaths as kind of the statistic that the media will talk about, but
sure.
You think about what happens is these are drugs that affect people's lives in a whole lot of other ways.
Well, let me get you in on the conversation. John, you work in an emergency room. How much do you deal with opioids or people wanting opioids or dealing with the after effect or the over effect of an overdose?
So working in the emergency room on the front lines, similarly to working in a primary care clinic, you encounter people in pain often. Opioids are a part of my practice every single day. I doubt I've ever worked a shift in an ER without, administering one to a patient.
Is that because it's the ER and people come in and some kind of health emergency?
Yeah, basically to treat pain. There's other uses for opioids to treat diarrhea and cough, but mainly to treat pain. And in the ER, you see everything from a patient who should be home eating chicken soup to someone who should be in an ICU and everything in between. And pain comes in every single variety. No two pains are ever the same. Even two kidney stones in the same person will produce two different kinds of pain. And so you're dealing with pain of most pain is certainly legitimate. In my article, I highlighted a patient who often came in complaining of pain,
This is a woman named Brittany that you called in this Washington Post article.
Right. Perhaps her pain was not always as severe as she said. But in most cases, people are in pain. people come to the ER because of pain. Pain is one of the most common reasons someone seeks help from a doctor, and it's the doctor's job to figure out why is this person in pain and to treat the pain. So, but then you also deal with overdoses of pain medication and people coming in requesting detox for an addiction, and kind of every aspect of what opioids does to humans presents itself to the ER.
Without going into a great deal of detail about your article, it was one of the reasons we wanted to have you on the show, is you had this well-known patient, I guess, who came into the ER complaining of pain. And the struggle that you had as a physician determining, is she lying? Is she malingering? Does she just want her fix and get out the door? Is this a person truly in pain? How did you decide?
Right. So it's complicated. And I think because of the outrageous statistics of opioid addiction, overdose, and death, you know, it's bred a lot of suspicion in physicians. And you can see a lot of the comments on that article where people who have legitimate causes of pain and felt like they were treated like drug seekers in an ER and, you know, are appropriately outraged by that. I understand why people are suspicious, and I understand why someone in true pain is outraged. It's just, it's complicated, and there's no great test for pain. So
if your pain is probably going to be different from my pain.
Right.
And you can't x-ray it.
Right. But so sometimes you can find a cause of pain. You know, that's my first job. When someone comes in pain, I want to know, why are they in pain? You know, does their pain fit a particular pattern? Does their abdominal pain, is it focused in one area of the abdomen that's common to appendicitis or a gallbladder issue or some other common, you know, problem that presents with a lot of pain? So your first job always is to figure out why is this person in pain, but ultimately to treat the pain, perhaps by treating the underlying cause of it. But, you know, there are causes of pain that can't be identified on a CT scan or an MRI. There, you know, if I find a kidney stone that fits the person's pattern of pain, great, I have a cause. They're, you know, they may get opioids if their pain is severe enough. I'm always very relieved and overjoyed when their pain is relieved with an anti-inflammatory and I don't have to step it up to an opioid. Or, right. Or a great time is when people actually say, I don't want an opioid. You know, I know they cause addiction. And that leads me to believe that educating the public, too, and for them to have a healthy fear of these medications also appropriate, is also part of the solution. But when you're in pain, sometimes nothing else will do.
Well, Anupam, let me go back to you and referencing something that President Trump said. Is this a prescription problem? Is that what we're dealing with here?
I think the prescription problem is part of it. As both of you probably know, for example, right now, many states and local municipalities are involved in litigation against pharmaceutical companies that produce opioids. And, you know, there's many concerns, but one of the concerns is that, you know, whether these companies were involved in deception and not adequately conveying their risk to physicians. And I think that's it's a valid thing to think about. But one thing that has struck me, and at least in our own research, is that physicians, probably unknowingly, have been a large part of the problem. So let me just give you a statistic.
Sure.
And you know, Jonathan can maybe this you can appreciate this. So we looked at data from Americans with Medicare. We looked at millions of patients who were seen in an emergency department. And what we found was that within the same emergency department, that the likelihood that a patient who came into the ED who had never received a prescription opioid, the likelihood that they left the ED with an opioid varied by almost threefold depending on who they saw. So at the low end, a prescriber might prescribe opioids to, let's say, you know, 7 or 8% of their patients. On the high end, in that top third of prescribers, an ED doctor might prescribe an opioid to, you know, 20 to 25% of their patients. And the key insight here is that these patients are essentially randomized to different ED providers because ED doctors work shifts. And they don't choose their patients, and their patients don't choose them. So this is not something about differences in patients having underlying, you know, differences underlying pain severity or seeking opioids. It's just all about the prescriber preference. And that prescriber variation probably has very little to do with interactions with the pharmaceutical industry. It probably has to do with how they were trained in medical school or in residency. Mm-hmm. And you see enormous variation. And in this case, that variation has implication for patients.
Well, and picking up on what you just said and also what John said earlier about pain, pain is subjective. So you could almost understand why different doctors might prescribe pain relievers or painkillers in a different way because of what that patient might be saying to them or just their own perception of what pain is. Can you speak to that, Anupam?
Sure. I mean, so there's subjectivity on the part of the patient and there's subjectivity on the part of the provider. But I would venture to guess that even two providers who, you know, have a similar understanding of a patient's pain, those two providers would prescribe different quantities and strengths of an opioid. So, for instance, if you see someone come into the emergency department with a kidney stone and you think, well, you know, they're in pain, appropriately so, let me prescribe an opioid. And then you say, well, they might still have pain for the next few days after they leave the ED. Well, then the question is, do you prescribe them 3 days worth of an opioid, 5 days, 7 days? What's the dosage or strength that you prescribe them? And I think two doctors or 10 doctors who have similar understandings of that patient's pain will prescribe different amounts of an opioid simply because there's no standardized way to prescribe opioids. You know, for other medications, we have standards. We start at a low dose and we escalate up to titrate to a response. But that's not the case for opioids.
You want to speak to that, John?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And, you know, even the same physician on different days will prescribe differently. Like, I'm very familiar with Anupam's excellent article about how a visit to the ER can lead to lasting opioid use. And I remember reading it. And it, you know, you read an article like that, the next shift you might give less, or anyone who gets an opioid might get a lower dose or a shorter duration of prescription. And I think, you know, based on the patients you've seen recently, based on the articles you've read recently, based on the horrifying statistics you've read recently, it might lead you to prescribe less or more. Or if, you know, it's very variable between physicians and even the same physician from shift to shift.
Anupam, let me go back to you. And taking that same example, is there a difference between what gets prescribed in the emergency room and what gets prescribed at your regular doctor's office, who presumably knows their patient better than someone working in an ER?
And there probably are differences. There's not a lot of good data on that. I would hypothesize that because ED doctors see a large volume of patients, particularly people who are coming in with pain, they're probably a bit more standardized even within themselves. Like the same doctor is probably prescribing a pretty standard dose for that particular physician. Whereas in the outpatient setting, if you see a primary care doctor, you know, they're not prescribing opioids every day. Many providers won't. And so part of this is just becoming familiar with what works and doesn't work. But even then, I think that there's still tremendous variation among all doctors and how they prescribe.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our guests to talk more about how, why, and when painkillers or opioids get prescribed. And talking with Anupam Jena, Associate Professor of Healthcare Policy at Harvard Medical School. Jonathan Reisman with us here in our Philadelphia studio. He's an ER physician at the Schuylkill Medical Center in Pottsville, PA, Cooper Hospital in Camden, New Jersey. He had a piece in the Washington Post recently and got us thinking about this topic. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoing, talking with our guests about managing pain when the management of pain has been called into question because of the opioid crisis. And again, Jonathan Reisman and Anupam Jena are our guests. You can join us at Radio Times at WHYY.org. Leave us a message. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. John, let me go back to you and actually go back to the piece that you had in the Washington Post where you said what you were taught in medical school. You graduated in 2010. That you really had to, in many ways, unlearn or relearn what you were taught in medical school.
Yep, it's true. I graduated less than a decade ago, and I distinctly remember getting lectures on the appropriate use of opioids. I remember being taught in lectures that appropriately prescribed opioid for a legitimate, you know, pain or painful condition rarely leads to opioid addiction. I remember getting lectures on how the elderly are at very low risk of getting addicted to opioid, not something we should worry about. And also got trained to, you know, have patients rate their pain on a scale of 0 to 10, with 0 being no pain, 10 being the worst pain of their life, and kind of treating that like another vital sign. We were told to think of pain as another vital sign, temperature, heart rate, blood pressure, and pain as well, and to treat it as you would alterations in those other other vital signs.
And how about now? It's obviously more complicated.
Sure. And the 0 to 10 scale is still in use. We don't have a lot of good tools to measure pain. And it is useful, the same person saying their pain's gone from a 9 to a 2, that's good news.
Right.
The treatment has worked.
And helpful, too.
Yes, it's helpful because there's no test for pain. So it's all subjective. So that rating scale is sort of all we have for the most part. But obviously now we know all too well that appropriately prescribed, opioids do lead to addiction, as some of Anupam's studies have shown, and a lot of other evidence, and that the elderly are at risk of addiction just like everybody else. And so it's been less than a decade, and I've certainly unlearned some of those lessons.
Anupam, let me go back to you, and I guess talking about opioids generally, is part of the problem is that they do work. They do take away pain.
I think that's the biggest problem. They take away pain. For some patients, they create euphoria. Pain is difficult to treat. I mean, if you were to think about a drug that would have immense value to society that hasn't been developed yet, a medication to treat pain that doesn't have the side effects that opioids have would be immensely valuable.
Right.
In some cases, we have other types of medications that can treat pain that John alluded to, but they don't always work, and for many patients, they don't work at all. And so you are sometimes stuck between a rock and a hard place of what to do for those patients. And I think part of what we should strive to do better as a profession is to understand who are those patients whose pain will probably not be improved significantly with opioids and who are at high risk for transitioning to long-term opioid dependence.
Anupam, let me go back to you. My understanding is that the prescriptions for opioids peaked maybe, 2010, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. And yet we're seeing this climbing death rate. What's the connection between these two, or is there?
There's probably a connection, I don't think it's well defined what the connection is. So I just offer a couple of possibilities. So
sure.
One possibility would be that individuals who started on prescription opioids are now transitioning to other forms of opioids that they may be obtaining illegally. For example, fentanyl, which is now a big problem in many communities. Another possibility is that what we're measuring as opioid prescriptions doesn't reflect the distribution of opioid use. So, for example, it could be that total prescriptions are going down, but prescription use among those who are most heavily using prescription opioids are actually going up.
Mm.
And it's those patients who are at highest risk for overdoses. So, for instance, we might be doing a better job at not prescribing opioids to very typical patients who probably don't need opioids, and doctors may be doing a better job at that, but they're not doing a good job cutting down on opioids on the types of patients that John described earlier. And those patients are the ones who are probably at highest risk of prescription opioids.
Now that there are more states that are legalizing medical marijuana, do you imagine, Anupam, that will become at least a substitute for using an opioid?
Could be a substitute. It could also be a complement. We don't really know. I mean, it could empirically could go both ways. You could imagine that people would use those two products in complement with one another. And I think, what we ultimately need is good data, which looks at what happens to states as they change their laws regarding marijuana use, and looking at both marijuana use and looking at opioid utilization and opioid overdoses in those states before and after.
John, you want to respond? I mean, I'm just thinking of all the options, or some of the options, I guess, that you have when you have patients telling you they are in pain.
Sure. There are several options, ranging from Tylenol to non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like ibuprofen, naproxen. And, there's kind of a ladder of stronger and stronger painkillers that we sometimes go through, stepping it up to see what works while always trying to use the minimum. And even within the class of opioids, there are weaker ones and stronger ones. Tylenol with codeine is a weaker option that's sometimes used for more mild pain, as where, there's a host of stronger ones that are used as needed. I think physicians have a lot to learn about marijuana. We don't traditionally think of it as a painkiller. We think of it as a treatment for nausea, vomiting. But there's a lot of anecdotal evidence out there and people who get benefit for pains of various sorts, nerve-related pain and other pains. And we didn't learn much about that in medical school. And so I think we have a lot to learn. And getting more data, as Anupam said, is key.
What about things like biofeedback or meditation or some of these other more, quote-unquote, alternative approaches?
I think at this point, any alternative to opioids would be very welcome if it helps anybody.
Oh, and I mean, that's a pretty emphatic statement that you just made. Yes?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, the epidemic of opioid addiction and overdose has shown the danger of these medications. And, you know, they have a place. They will always have a place, I think, in medicine and in pain relief. But obviously, the side effects for a society when they're overused are devastating.
Yeah. Let me see what Michael from Westchester has to say. And Michael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I recently slipped on the ice and broke my wrist, and that brought this to my attention. And there are two things that I in my opinion, kind of need to happen. I'd like to hear your guests talk about it. One is someone, the nurse, physician's assistant, or the doctor, needs to discuss the purpose of pain medication with the patient. And some people think it's to eliminate pain. In my case, I think it's to manage pain. Mm. So I take it to get pain down to an acceptable level. But someone who thinks that may need to be it's there to eliminate pain may take a lot more of the pain medication. And number two, the way the instructions are given, typically you're told take it every, say, 4 to 6 hours or as needed for pain. I hear take it as needed for pain no more than every 4 to 6 hours, but someone else may hear every 4 to 6 hours or more often as you need it for pain.
Those are really good points, Michael. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Anupam Jena, you want to respond?
Sure, Michael. Those are excellent points. I think that's on the shoulders of the providers. I mean, we really should be doing a better job of spending a little bit more time explaining that these drugs are intended to reduce pain, not to eliminate pain, that they have side effects, describing how they should be taken, what things you should watch out for. So I completely agree with you. And what you described, I think, is very common. You know, whether it a wrist fracture, whether it be even a sprained ankle where we could see someone prescribed opioids, or a minor dental procedure, this happens all the time. And part of the solution is just spending an extra 5 minutes talking to a patient to describe, you know, what the next few weeks will look like.
Anupam, do we know the percentage of people who are prescribed by a doctor, by their doctor, let's say, or by our guest, Jonathan Reisman, how many of them actually become addicted to this opioid? Do we know?
Yeah, well, I mean, we have some estimates. So, for instance, in our study, we looked at emergency medicine physicians, and the estimates may differ depending on what kind of doctors you look at. But, you know, about 1 out of every 100 patients who went in the emergency department who had not been on a prescription opioid before and received an opioid at the time of discharge from the ED, about 1 out of 100 of those patients would then be on an opioid 1 to 2 years later.
Hmm.
And the interesting thing is that if a patient happened to see a doctor who was in this top third of prescribing rates, so these are doctors who prescribed opioids to about 20 to 25% of their patients, the likelihood that that patient, who, again, was essentially by chance seen by that doctor, is about 30% more in terms of being on an opioid at a year later. So there is this addiction component that John described.
Anupam Jena joining us along with Jonathan Reisman. Anupam Jena is Associate Professor of Healthcare Policy at Harvard Medical School, a physician in the Department of Medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital, also a faculty research fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Jonathan Reisman is emergency room physician at the Schuylkill Medical Center in Pottsville, PA, just outside of Philadelphia. Also a Cooper Hospital in Camden, New Jersey, also outside of Philadelphia. And we are talking about pain medication, about opioids, the problem of overdose, of overprescribing, of underprescribing. And let me read some more comments here. This is from Stu. What caused the sudden change in doctors' attitudes towards opioid potential for addiction? Can you answer that? And there was a period where pain medication was withheld for fear of addiction. Then, as you said, in medical school, the thought was, well, we can manage this, and now we're rethinking it again. What caused the change of heart?
Sure. Well, I think part of it was, you know, pain probably was undertreated. I guess it's hard to say. I wasn't a physician at that time, actually. And I remember actually, when I was in high school, my mother reading articles in newspapers about the undertreatment of pain and her, you know, disgust with these physicians who, how could you not treat pain? What could be crueler to have access and to hold the key to these, you know, most powerful of pain-relieving substances and to withhold them from people in true pain?
And it seemed cruel.
Yeah, and it is cruel. You know, I recognize that. And that's... you know, I think there was a bit of a kind of a backlash against that. And I don't think that was the only reason, but that was probably part of why the pendulum swung towards more and more prescribing. And there's a risk as we pull back and prescribe less, there is a risk of undertreatment of pain. And, you know, when I'm in the ER and I'm doing my best to only treat those who need it, you know, I know that I am creating some addicts, as statistics show, even by treating legitimate things. Well, like as a NUPM study showed, you know, I consider myself in the lower end of how many opioids I prescribe compared to other physicians. But if I treat 100 people with a kidney stone, I might be creating one addict or more.
Hmm.
And that's a risk. And at the same time, if I do my best to only treat, you know, appropriately and only prescribe when needed, there's going to be people who leave in pain who might have, you know, needed it, and I'm going to withhold it from them. But that's, you know, that's the balance, and it's really hard, overtreating and undertreating. It's very hard to strike a right balance, and lots of data is needed.
Well, absolutely. Let me play something else that President Trump said. This was his speech last week on the opioid epidemic. Manchester, New Hampshire. Let's give it a listen.
Because we can have all the blue ribbon committees we want, but if we don't get tough on the drug dealers, we're wasting our time. Just remember that. We're wasting our time. And that toughness includes the death penalty.
Anupam, that got a round of applause. It's been debated in the last week since the president said that. But hearing Jonathan Reisman basically saying, look, I prescribe knowing that a small percentage of people I prescribe to might become addicted, raises the questions about who are these quote-unquote drug dealers that the president is talking about. What do you say?
That's a good question. I think the drug dealers that he's talking about, I wouldn't put physicians into that category. You know, Jonathan touched on this idea, which is central to everything in medicine, and that is the two words, or one word, trade-off. Right. Everything that we do in a hospital or in a clinic involves a trade-off. So when we decide to give a medicine for blood pressure, for someone's blood pressure who's high, we recognize that there's a possibility that their blood pressure might go too low. Or something as benign as an antibiotic, we recognize that there are side effects of antibiotics that in some patients could even be potentially deadly, but we make that trade-off. And I think many would agree that at this point we've erred too far on the side of prescribing opioids, but it would be incorrect to say that they don't offer any benefit to patients. That's a very different narrative than the narrative of an organization or an individual who is selling drugs for the purposes of, you know, essentially creating a business. I think that's a different set of individuals. But, you know, there is a role for physicians to play. There's no doubt about it, whether it be prescribing that leads to long-term opioid dependence and then illicit use that's obtained through outside of the medical realm, or whether it's an older woman who is prescribed an opioid and takes too many unknowingly and then suffers a fall, and then as a result of the fall has, you know, long-term medical issues. You know, both things are equally damaging to individuals.
I mean, this is more anecdotal, but about doctors, pharmacists, or pharmacies abusing the system. There was a town in West Virginia that had, I mean, the prescription rate for opioids was multiple times the population there. Anupam, are there companies that are abusing this situation?
I think they probably are. You know, and I think that there are also probably physicians who are abusing the system. But I think that, you know, those physicians we can identify. It's not that difficult with the existing databases to identify physicians who are prescribing abnormally high levels of opioids, and then systematically intervening on those physicians to understand whether or not it's appropriate or not. Quite possibly it won't be appropriate. I think that's something that we can fix. Organizations like the DEA or the FDA or state medical boards can absolutely get involved and have already started to get involved in physicians in that form. I think pharmacies and wholesalers that may also be benefiting from selling opioid prescriptions, it's a different issue because, you know, ultimately the pharmacist can't prescribe an opioid. That decision happens at the pen of a physician. Mm. And so I think ultimately what we really want to do is figure out how to get physicians to prescribe opioids more appropriately and then also to identify high prescribing physicians who may have a kind of disproportionate impact in terms of these adverse events that are happening from opioids.
Let me read a couple of more comments. One from Patri: why do oral surgeons prescribe opioids to teens after wisdom teeth removal? Shouldn't they wait and see if the kids really need it? An email from Hillary: I'm a recovering alcoholic, and in 2010 I had my gallbladder removed. I told the doctors I was in recovery and to give me the mildest drug. They prescribed Percocet and only a few days worth. I had my mom hold on to it. I only took it for a few days and switched to Advil. I didn't want to jeopardize my recovery and sobriety. Hillary, good for you. An email from Eric in Philadelphia: do 21st century humans experience pain that surpasses the pain felt by people 50 years ago? People managed then. This is about profit over lives, all behind a fig leaf of giving people what they want. That's a flavor of some of the comments to our conversation. And I do want to take another short break. We'll get right back to our conversation talking about painkillers, opioids, legal and illegal, and its effect on people's health, on our economy, on our country. Some 42,000 Americans have died in the last couple of years every year from an opioid overdose. And we're talking with Jonathan Reisman. He's an emergency room physician, and Anupam Jena from Harvard Medical School. 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. Give us a call. Also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. John, let me ask you about naloxone. We were talking about that during the break. We haven't really discussed this. There was actually a librarian up in the Kensington section of Philadelphia who was, I think it was her library near a park, and she saw people overdosing, and she learned how to use naloxone. How often do you use that as a ER doc?
So I use it quite a bit working in ERs. Schuylkill County certainly has its share of opioid abusers. And actually, often people will be brought in by paramedics or EMS having already gotten naloxone on the scene because of, you know, the prevalence of opioid overdose these days. Thankfully, there has been a push to have it more readily accessible in the field and not having to wait to get people in the ER. So people are often – who have overdosed either accidentally or on purpose are often – awake and agitated and angry and not happy to see me by the time they get there, thankfully. Sometimes they need additional doses, you know, and then it's sort of like, well, what do you do at that point?
Well, I was going to say, what do you do next, right?
So what do you do? So there, you know, there's if there's not always great options. There has been a push lately in some larger academic medical centers like Mass General to start, medications for addiction in the ER, specifically Suboxone. But that's something that has not spread to other hospitals, though I think shows great promise since it does both treat withdrawal and reduce craving at the same time. So the other thing that is necessary is getting prompt follow-up in a clinic that specializes in, you know, full medical services and often social services and other things for people struggling with opioid abuse. And that's something that is definitely not widely available, but something that's definitely needed.
Anupam, let me go back to you. And I believe I read something that you wrote that in order to deal with this crisis of opioids, we'd have to spend something like $250 billion a year. Do we have a medical system set up to deal with this crisis?
I think the current medical system is not set up to deal with it. And part of the problem is that there's a lot of fragmentation in policies across states. So some states have specific policies for towards naloxone access laws. Other states do not. There's another issue of how do you adequately treat patients, not for overdose of opioids, but just in terms of treating patients who have become addicted to opioids. And how should Medicaid, which is, you know, run at the state level for the most part, cover these patients?
Absolutely. Let me see what Anne from Philadelphia has to say. Anne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
My, so many issues so intertwined.
Indeed.
I don't even know how to slice this down to one topic, but having been in the hospital a few too many times in the past 6 months, I'd first like to say I'm very thankful to the medical profession, and they came through in flying colors for me.
Good.
However, having been released from a hospital and with knowing that I was getting ill, physically ill, from the opioid that they had given me for pain, I was still released with a 30-pill bottle of opioid. And I said at the time, I didn't want it because it makes me sick. And their response was, well, you may need it for breakthrough pain. So along with the other medications that they gave me, I took it home. And then not needing it, I wanted to give it back. Mm-hmm. And the hospitals and the pharmacies don't take it back. They're not easy to get rid of. And the other issue is, I'm very curious when the gentleman said that, during his education, he was taught about opioids. Who taught you? Was it a representative from a pharmaceutical company?
Those are all excellent questions, and there's so many other people that want to get in on the conversation, so I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Can you answer her last question, John?
Sure. I was not taught by a pharmaceutical representative. In fact, I remember the family physician who was then retired but worked in administration who gave us that lecture, and he was one of the most compassionate physicians that I've ever met. And his heart was always in the right place, and he was the furthest thing from a mouthpiece for pharmaceutical industries. And, you know, medical science is imperfect, and we go through periods where we, you know, wholeheartedly ascribe to what later turns out to be utterly false convictions, and we improperly treat a lot of people based on those convictions. And sometimes the ramifications are not good.
And I appreciate the call. And Anupam, let me take her call and add it to a tweet from Anand, who says, as a pharmacist, I've seen way too many patients that come in and talk about how they were handed an opioid prescription by the prescriber and not given any other option. I asked this earlier in the hour, but is this a prescription problem?
I think there is a large prescription problem. There's non-uniformity in how physicians prescribe opioids, meaning the same patient will get two different types of opioid prescriptions that last 5 days versus 15 days or have different strengths. There's probably immense variability in terms of how much communication happens at the time that prescription is offered to a patient. It's common to be in a situation where patients are prescribed an opioid, don't use all the tablets, and then they remain at home. I think that happens at least 30% of the time, probably even 50% of the time would be a reasonable estimate based on the studies that I've seen.
Did you want to add something? Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I just want to point out the incentives for a physician working in an ER or discharging a patient from the hospital, sending them home. If you don't give them anything, they might show up 2 days later in pain. And it's sort of like, well, why didn't you give them appropriate pain medication? You diagnose them with this obviously painful condition. Are you cruel? Are you a bad doctor? They showed up 2 days later in pain, and a different physician had to treat their pain appropriately. On the other side, overtreating or overprescribing, 2 years later, one of 500 patients you saw is addicted to heroin.
Yep.
You never find out about that. So it's sort of like the ramifications are so unbalanced and so different in terms of undertreating and overtreating.
Let me read an email from Adrian. Says pharmaceutical companies created this problem through their dishonest and profit-oriented marketing practices. We should roll back the use of opioids to 1999 levels. Anupam, do you agree with that?
I don't agree with that. Here's the reason why. I think that there are a lot of people where we can, you know, I will use the word blame, but there's a lot of parties to potentially blame in terms of why we are where we're at now. But one thing is important to remember is that we've known about how we've been in opioid crisis for years now. This is not the first time that we're hearing about this in the last 2 years. We've heard about this for a while, and still prescriptions remain very high. Still, there's extraordinary variability across physicians. Still, hospitals don't have standardized prescribing procedures for their physicians. Still, there are no federal quality measures that are related to prescription opioids in terms of measuring how often patients are prescribed them. And this has absolutely nothing to do with the pharmaceutical industry. So there's issues that the pharmaceutical industry probably should take be accountable for. But, you know, this is now said and done, and why are we still doing what we're doing? It doesn't make any sense to me.
What should we do, though?
I'm going to defer that question to John.
I mean, I hear the nuance, the complexity. We're dealing with pain. It's subjective. You try to do your best. You know that you're going to make some mistakes along the way. I mean, maybe we can live with that. Maybe that's good enough.
Sure. Well, I think every physician, you know, just through training gets used to the fact that their treatments might do harm. As Anupam mentioned before, there's no risk-free medication. Everything has side effects. If a medication has no side effects, I often say it probably doesn't work. I see one patient at a time, and I try to minimize, prescriptions, and I try to only treat appropriately. And it's hard, and I go back and forth in my head a lot on the same patient or different patients with the same condition. You know, I'm always in favor of an all-of-the-above approach. Getting physicians to change their ingrained practices, developing alternatives, educating the public on the danger of these substances. You know, like some of the callers and commenters have said, they have refused the medications. I mean, that just is great. I think people have to realize the risks of these medications, and if they're not needed, they need to push back on physicians who are too ready to prescribe them, just so they're not, you know, chastised 2 days later because they undertreated someone's pain.
Anupam, does a no approach to opioids, but even as President Trump said, we should not just lock people up, but use a death penalty for drug pushers. What is the best way to help people? I'm struggling with my words here. Help people not get hooked on painkillers.
You know, there's criminal issues, and then there's medical and prescribing issues. On the criminal issues, I really don't have any good insights, and except to say is we should do what the evidence tells us. And I'm sure his statements are not based on the evidence. Related to the criminal aspects of these issues. Now, with respect to the medical profession, there's a few things that we can think about doing, some of which are already being done but may not be done as well. So states, for instance, have prescription drug monitoring programs that are designed to monitor prescribing that looks aberrant. So, for example, a patient who might be filling opioid prescriptions from multiple pharmacies crossing state lines. Those prescription programs are variably used by physicians, so physicians are not mandated to use that information at the time of prescribing in most states. And so that's something that should change. Education of physicians is a lofty goal, but there are tangible ways that we can do this. So, for instance, in residency, where physicians' prescribing patterns are really built and ingrained, there should be a standardized curriculum for prescribing. We have standardized ways that we treat hypertension, but there's no such way that that's done in the hospital. And I would bet that if we were to look at physicians at our own hospital, resident physicians or other hospitals, teaching hospitals, you will see it at 2 weeks after internship begins that there's incredible variability. And there's no effort at all to reduce that variability. And that's something that we can do at the early onset. And then there's big data approaches, such as implementing prescribing protocols or pathways into electronic health records that have shown some promise. So there's a lot of things that we can do, and the question is, why haven't we done that, and what are the incentives that are not properly aligned to get us there?
I do want to follow up with that, but let me first get Lisa from Ridley Park to join us. And Lisa, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I am a stage 4 cancer person, and I take an opioid for my pain, and I have never had a problem with it, never OD, never thought it was too much. I don't have an addictive personality for other things like, you know, alcohol or anything else like that, and that might be an issue for some, but they, you know, over the years they have raised it slowly, and I just want to make sure that it will not be taken from me through my hospital. I don't see them as drug pushers, because it has been nothing but extremely helpful and needed and necessary. And so I just wanted to make sure that, you know, all the things the president is saying, he seems like he has this overall arching idea that everybody's a pill pusher and everybody's a drug addict that takes it. And that's not the case. You know, for me, it's necessary and a must. And I just wanted to make sure that I will always be able to get it from my doctor this year, 10 years from now. And that when I walk into my pharmacy, you know, people aren't looking at me like, because I used to think that. But now it's so necessary and, you know, for me to control the pain.
Well, Lisa, I really appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I'm glad it's helping you with your pain. Is there a danger, John, of that? These are these pendulum swings we've been talking about.
Sure, and I think, you know, often we talk about cancer in a class of its own because it is so can be so painful. A lot of the studies on chronic opioid use focus on non-cancer reasons to prescribe the opioids appropriately. You know, cancer is often very painful, and it is an appropriate reason to give opioids, and it would be cruel to withhold them from people. There are also a lot of people with chronic back pain, let's say, who stably take one opioid pill on just the worst days to get them through it, and don't need to take it every day, don't up the dose, don't do other drugs, do not become, you know, addicted or dependent. And probably that's a small percentage of the people who are on chronic opioids for non-cancer related pains. But there are those people who need them. And like I said, these medications are always going to be part of medical practice.
Anupam, is there a difference between then addiction and dependence? And we have an email from Patricia wanting to know whether there's a difference between physical addiction and psychological addiction. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think that there are differences. The treatments may be also different. So I completely agree. And, you know, I think to what Lisa said, first of all, thank you for sharing that story. But I completely agree. And I do think that we have enough understanding of the medical issues now, and we should have enough time to be able to figure out who are the people who should be on opioids and who are the people who should not. And my instinct would be that as we start to implement policies that are designed to reduce utilization, I think physicians will and to be honest, must focus on inappropriate utilization. That's where we have to reduce use. We don't want to touch use in patients who are getting benefits from it.
Anupam, we're almost out of time here, but I didn't ask you a question about the effect of this opioid crisis on our economy, and that's part of what you have looked at. What, I mean, we talk about 42,000 people dying from a overdose. Can we quantify its effect on our economy? We're almost out of time here.
Yeah, you know, there have been studies that have tried to do this and look at things like unemployment in areas where opioid use is very high, but you can imagine these studies are hard to interpret because the relationships are cyclical. So what caused what? It's a chicken and egg problem, but there's a lot of thinking around that.
Anupam, Jenna, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And he joined us from the studios of Harvard Medical School, and he is Associate Professor of Healthcare Policy at Harvard Medical School and a physician in the Department of Medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital. Jonathan Reisman, thank you so much for coming in and joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. He's an emergency room physician at the Schuylkill Medical Center in Pottsville, PA, also at Cooper Hospital in Camden, New Jersey. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.